Blog Talk Radio.
You're listening to the Totally Driven Entertainment Radio Network.
In the future, none of you are heroes.
You're legends.
Get driven, stay driven.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to the Bareback Facts. Today, we are going to be talking about a very controversial figure from history and an individual who's sort of flown under the radar for mainstream historians, one that many of you probably have never even heard of, and that is a crying shame because this guy is probably one of the biggest pieces of human trash to ever walk the face of the earth. And that is King Leopold II of Belgium and the creator of the Congo Free State. Perhaps for those of you unfamiliar with King Leopold, today you're going to get a crash course in why King Leopold really is an awful human being and what he should be most famous for and why. So let's get right into it. Let's get right into who King Leopold is specifically. Now, King Leopold II, whose name in full is Leopold Louis Philippe Marie Victor, Dutch. His Dutch name in full is Leopold Lodewijk Philips Maria Victor. He was born April 9th in 1835 in Brussels, Belgium, and he would die in December 17th of 1909 in Laeken. He was king of Belgium from 1865 to 1909. And he's most often referred to as an ambitious man and the man who brought Belgium onto the world stage as a colonial power. Now, before we delve too deep into King Leopold and his various machinations and his various cruel institutions, I want to remind you all that we have a guest call-in number at 718-508-9883. So feel free to call in anytime with questions, comments, concerns, and I will do my best to get to you. In the meantime, we are going to dive right into this. Now that you've been formally introduced to King Leopold II, he was best known for being keen on establishing Belgium as an imperial power. He wanted to show the world that Belgium, too, was a power to be reckoned with, much like Britain and France and Germany and America eventually. He led the first European efforts to develop the Congo River Basin, making possible the formation in 1885 of the Congo Free State, and which was annexed in 1908 as the Belgian Congo, and now the Democratic Republic of the Congo, otherwise known as the DRC. Now, although he played a significant role in the development of the modern Belgium state, it's important to note that today we'll be talking about the widespread atrocities that he committed under his rule against his colonial subjects and the various policies he instituted to ensure that they were productive for his new empire. The country of Belgium itself was only about 5 years old at the birth of Leopold II, who became the eldest surviving son of King Leopold I, who was the first king of the Belgians. Now, he would be the son of his father's second wife, Louise Marie of Orléans. Now, then, as they would be into the 21st century, most of the royal families of Europe were interrelated. For instance, Leopold's II's first cousin was the first cousin of Queen Victoria of Britain, and he became Duke of Brabant in 1846 and served in the Belgian army. In 1853, he married Marie Henriette, daughter of the Austrian Archduke Joseph Palatine of who was the Palatine of Hungary, and became King of the Belgium upon his father's death in December of 1865. So, early life, not too shabby. Grew up in a nice, cushy royal family. Most of the monarchs in Western Europe had been forced to largely yield their political power to the electorate by the late 19th century. So despite being king, Belgium's parliament and cabinet were the real locus of power. But Leopold himself used the prestige of the monarchy to lobby for pet projects. And although the domestic affairs of his reign were dominated by a growing conflict between the liberal and Catholic parties over suffrage and education issues, Leopold concentrated on developing the country's defenses. He was aware that Belgian neutrality maintained during the Franco-German War in 1870 to 1871, otherwise known as the Franco-Prussian War, was imperiled by the increasing strength of France and Germany. He persuaded Parliament in 1887 to finance the fortification of Liège and Namur. Now, the royal coffers would become a central focus of Leopold's life, and once he once grumbled to German Emperor William II while watching a parade in Berlin that there's really nothing left for us kings except money. Leopold soon decided that the best way to acquire wealth would be by establishing an African colony. And it's at this time when the great European scramble for Africa was underway. That's right, everybody in Europe decided Africa is just the place to be now. In 1870, more than 80% of Africa south of the Sahara was under the rule of indigenous chiefs or kings. 40 years later, virtually all of it had been transformed into European colonies, protectorates, or territories ruled by white settlers. That's an astonishing amount of land to cover in such a short time. You don't realize how big Africa is as a continent, but it's very large. Percent of it, for almost more than 80% of it to be pretty much conquered or controlled in just the span of about 40 years is pretty impressive. It's also pretty terrifying when you think about it. So let's dive right into Leopold and what he thought about going to Africa. Now, like so many of the other European powers at the time, France and Britain to be more specific, they saw Africa as a perfect place to pick up natural resources. They wanted to expand into Africa to acquire natural resources and cash crops. This was the real grab for these imperial powers. Their coffers were really starting to take hits from all the warring that they had done with one another and from their other various efforts to expand and find revenue. So Africa became the place to be in the late 1860s all the way into the 1900s. We see a start of all these European powers, particularly Britain, France, Germany, and even America, are starting to branch off into Africa, the Pacific, and parts of Asia, mostly Southeast Asia, in particular with France, Britain, but also China, and even the South Pacific. So this is a period of vast colonial and imperial expansion on the part of the European powers, and eventually even the United States gets in on this action. But first, back to Leopold on the Congo Free State. Now, presenting himself as a philanthropist eager to bring the benefits of Christianity, Western civilization, and commerce to African natives, a guise that he had perpetuated for many years, Leopold hosted an international conference of explorers and geographers at the Royal Palace in Brussels in the year 1876. Several years later, he hired the explorer Henry Morton Stanley to be his man in Africa. He's going to be the guy. For 5 years, Stanley would travel up and down the immense waterways of the Congo River Basin, setting up trading posts, building roads, and persuading local chiefs, almost entirely illiterate, by the way, local chiefs, to sign treaties with Leopold. Now, keep in mind, all these treaties are pretty much signed in Dutch. Obviously, these native people of this area, particularly obviously the Congolese, don't speak Dutch. They don't read Dutch. They have no idea what the hell Stanley's talking about, but he shows up and they sign these treaties. Because why not? This guy seems like a nice guy. He's giving us stuff. We're giving him stuff. Seems like it's working out. That's when things go horribly wrong. Now, the treaties, some of them, which appear to have been subsequently doctored to Leopold's liking, were then put to use by the Belgian monarch.
Now, although Belgium's government felt that the colonies would be an extravagance for a small country with no navy or merchant marine, that situation suited Leopold perfectly. He persuaded first the United States and then all major nations of Western Europe to recognize a huge swath of Central Africa, roughly the same territory as the modern-day Democratic Republic of Congo, as his personal property. He called it Etat Independent du Congo, the Congo Free State. It was the world's only private colony, and Leopold referred to himself as its proprietor. Oh, boy, oh, boy. This could not possibly go wrong. And by the way, this is an incredibly vast, vast piece of Africa. This is a very large piece. The king then embarked on an ultimately successful effort to make a vast fortune from his new possession. Initially, he was most interested in ivory, a material that was greatly valued in the days before plastics because it could be carved into a great variety of shapes, statuettes, jewelry, piano keys, false teeth, and many other oddities and commodities that can be sold. For some years, ivory was a principal source of the great wealth that Leopold and his associates drew from the new colony. In a very famous novella written by Joseph Conrad, The Heart of Darkness, Joseph Conrad, who spent 6 months in the Congo in 1890 as a steamboat officer, gives a searing picture of the brutal and voracious European quest for Congo ivory. We'll talk about Heart of Darkness a little bit later on because it's a real eye-opener. Now, by the 1890s, a new source of riches had appeared. A worldwide boom was occurring, and Belgium was damn sure not going to be left behind if Leopold II had anything to say about it. He considered himself a captain of industry, a man of no limits on his ingenuity, a man who was determined. Completely and utterly determined to squeeze every single last drop out of his new colonial possession. And he was about to do just that because Leopold was about to hit the home run of all home runs. Because during the 1890s, there was a massive economic boom that was occurring. And that boom was kicked off by a very, very interesting commodity. That commodity was rubber. It was kicked by the invention of the inflatable bicycle tire and then spurred on by the rise of the automobile and the use of rubber in industrial belts and gaskets, as well as in coating for telephone and telegraph wires. Throughout the tropics, people rushed to sow rubber trees, but those plants could take many years to reach maturity. And in the meantime, there was money to be made wherever rubber could grow wild. One lucrative source of wild rubber was the landolphia vines in the great Central African rainforest, and no one owned more of that area than Leopold. Detachments of his 19,000-man private army, the Force Publique, would march into a village and hold the women hostage, forcing the men to scatter into the rainforest and gather a monthly quota of wild rubber. As the price of rubber soared, the quotas would be increased, and as vines near a village were drained dry, men desperate to free their wives and daughters would have to walk days or weeks to find new vines to tap. And if you think that this is brutal, we're just getting started. Other parts of the Congo economy, from road building to chopping wood for steamboat boilers, operated by forced labor as well. Because one thing that Leopold II was absolutely determined he wasn't going to do was spend money on this colony. Absolutely not. He was going to milk this thing for all it was worth. And what better way to do that than with free labor? So tens of possibly hundreds of thousands of Congolese people fled their villages to avoid being impressed as forced laborers, and they sought refuge deep in the forest where there was little food and very little shelter. And the effects of this forced labor were incredibly devastating. Many of the women hostages would starve to death, and many of the male rubber gatherers would be worked to death. Tens of thousands of others were shot down in failed rebellions against the regime, and one particularly notorious practice grew out of the suppression of those rebellions. To prove that he had wasted bullets, or worse yet, saved them for use in a mutiny, for each bullet expended, a Congolese soldier of the Force Publique had to present to his white officer the severed hand of a rebel whom he killed. Baskets of severed hands thus resulted from Expeditions Against Rebels. If a soldier fired at someone and missed or used a bullet to shoot game, he then sometimes had to cut off the hand of a living victim to show it to his officer and prove that he had not wasted a bullet. Because if there was one thing that we're learning about Leopold, it's that he was cheap and that he wasn't willing to spend a whole lot of money on his investment. He wanted money to come from it. Some might say that he was a good businessman, but he was a man who lacked really any sense of morality or any sense of humanity. Now, with women held as hostages and men forced to tap rubber, few able-bodied adults are able to cultivate crops. Millions of Congolese then found themselves suffering from near famine, which made them vulnerable to diseases they otherwise might have survived. Furthermore, as in any society where men and women are separated, traumatized, or in flight as refugees, the birth rate of the Congo dropped precipitously. No one will ever know the precise figures because these things weren't really written down. You don't really write down how many people you're murdering usually. But from all these causes, demographers estimate that between the year 1880 and 1920, the population of the Congo might have been slashed by up to 50%, from perhaps 20 million people at the beginning of that period to an estimated 10 million at the end. The forced labor system for gathering rubber was swiftly copied by French, German, and Portuguese colonial officers with equally fatal results. These officials saw the success of Leopold in harvesting so much rubber in such a short period of time that they believed that the only way to keep up with supply and demand of rubber was to duplicate the cruel, cruel actions of Leopold's regime in the Free State. Now, because the system's effects in the Congo could so easily be blamed on one man who could safely be attacked because he did not represent a great power, and an international outcry focused on Leopold, that pressure finally forced him to relinquish his ownership of the territory, and it became the Belgian Congo in 1908. Leopold, however, made the Belgian government pay him for his prized possession and would die the following year. Because his only son predeceased him, Leopold's nephew, Albert I, would succeed him to the throne. But this is not the end of our discussion. This is far from the end of our discussion of the Congo Rubber Terror and King Leopold. I do want to talk about his lasting legacy, and I do want to talk more about the horrific practices of the men from Belgium who worked in the Congo and oversaw their own Congolese soldiers. But before we get into those details, before we get into the lasting legacy of King Leopold amongst his own countrymen, and we get deeper into the brutal exploitation of the Congolese people during the Congo Rubber Terror, we're going to take a commercial break, and it's at this time that I'd like to remind you all that we do have a proud new sponsor at Totally Driven Entertainment. He's funny, he's wacky, and he's crazy. Check out ChrisFraleyPresents.com.
I'm Black Man, saving man's eyes, one stereotype at a time.
To the Black Mother. To the corner of Martin Luther King Street and Malcolm X Boulevard, pronto.
Will Black Man make it to the crime on time? Or will he be on CPT? Stay tuned at ChrisFraleyPresents.com.
Attention business owners, website owners, event promoters, or anyone looking to promote your product. The Totally Driven Entertainment Radio Network is the perfect way to spread the word of your business around the world. That's right, you can advertise at our network and be played on all of our shows at rates that are so cheap, it's a no-brainer. For more information, contact Bay Ragney at bayragney@gmail.com. To keep your business driven, stay driven with Totally Driven Entertainment.
Are you a fan of Sherlock Holmes? Letters from Holmes offers unique, one-of-a-kind letters from the world-famous detective himself. Handwritten on 8.5-inch by 11-inch aged parchment paper and using smudge-free ink to produce original, high-quality letters that fans will treasure for years to come. Each letter is handcrafted and written from the perspective of Sherlock Holmes, mimicking Holmes's native tongue and embracing many of the famous detective's quirks, quips, insults, and peculiarities. Order a love letter, birthday greeting, personal correspondence, or more only at www.etsy.com/shop/lettersfromhomes.
For $5 today, you can buy a wealth of things. Gas for your car, rent a movie for the family, a few slices of pizza. $5 still takes you a long ways. But did you know that $5 can buy your child a bag of heroin in the streets? That's right. For only $5, your son or daughter can buy some of the cheapest and purest dope in the country. Be aware of the lies. Be aware of the stealing. Be aware that's all it takes to kill your child. $5. This message was brought to you by Casey's Cause, a group of parents located in Southern Chester County out to save your child's life. Come join us today at www.caseyscause.com. And remember, $5 is all it takes. Casey's Cause, www.caseyscause.com.
Looking for that perfect gift for your girlfriend? Then look no further than Teddy Scares. Teddy Scares are available in a variety of styles, sizes, and prices for all your shopping needs. Teddy Scares are a mix of cute and creepy to make a great gift for almost any age. Board up your windows, lock your doors, and log on to TeddyScares.com. And be sure to become our friends at Facebook.com/TeddyScares.
Calling all comic book fans. Do you collect comics? Did you ever collect comics? Do you think your children might like reading comic books? Do you even know they still print real, paper, non-digital comic books? Well then visit the Pirates of Ontario Street Comics in Philadelphia. We have a massive collection of comic books, action figures, trading cards, and much more. We have one of the largest stocks of back-issue comics in the area. We bag and board every new comic book at no extra charge. Our store is voted the best comic book shop in the 2013 PHL 17 Hot List Contest. Part of the movie Unbreakable is filmed in our store. We are open 7 days a week. Ontario Street Comics is located at 2235 East Ontario Street in the Port Richmond section of Philly. Our phone number is 215-288-7338. Type in the words Ontario Comics Philadelphia to check out our wacky stores page on Facebook.
Welcome back to the Bareback Facts, everybody. Hope you enjoyed the commercial break. Hope you found some positivity there where you're lacking it here on the show today. But that's become the theme of the show this season, hasn't it? A little bit of darkness. But speaking of darkness, we're getting back to talking about King Leopold and his atrocities in the Congo. Now, I mentioned before that King Leopold ended up having to give up control of the Congo to the parliament, to the country as a whole. But by the end of his life, Leopold was incredibly unpopular with his people. Ironically enough, however, it had very little to do with his actions in Africa, and more so to do with his conduct during his personal life. He spoke contemptuously of Belgium's small size. He couldn't speak proper Dutch, which was the native language of more than half of the country's citizens, so you might want to be able to do that, and spent long winters in luxurious quarters on the French Riviera. He was also estranged from two of his three daughters. Moreover, he had a well-known penchant for teenaged girls, and when he was at the age of 65, he began a liaison with a teenage former prostitute who bore him two additional children. So really kind of a deplorable individual in every sense of the word. He really didn't care about the lives of the innocent people in the Congo, whom he was tormenting on a daily basis through the arm of a private army. And he didn't really care about his reputation or his family, and he had a general contempt for his own country and people. This sort of harkens back to Kaiser Wilhelm, oddly enough, who once said, for those of you unfamiliar with him, he was the emperor, if you will, of Germany. The northern part of Germany, specifically Prussia. But he once said that he only spoke French, or he only spoke German to his servants and his dogs. He believed French to be the height of language. That's what an aristocrat speaks. Oddly enough, it seems that Leopold shared his contempt of his own country and his countrymen pretty much, at least in the context of the Dutch. Now, he is remembered in Belgium for some of what he built with his wealth from the Congo, such as the monumental Arcade du Cinq
Quantenaire in Brussels and for his advocacy of strong fortifications in the eastern part of the country, which incidentally would slow down the advance of German troops in 1914 at the beginning of the First World War. His most important legacy, however, remains the human catastrophe that the rubber forced labor system brought to the Congo, a heritage that continued to echo in that region more than a century after Leopold's death. Despite his horrendous actions towards the people of the Congo, amongst his own people, it was his social discrepancies that they despised more so than what he was doing to make the country look bad abroad. Which I find particularly interesting. Now, King Leopold is known to have really not had a whole lot of positive things to say about the Congo Free State. What he really concerned himself with was profits. Now, his reign in the Congo earned infamy on account of the massive mistreatment of the local people. In addition to extracting ivory and rubber, he also extracted minerals in the Upper Congo Basin for sale on the world market. Everything from gold, silver, wood, anything that wasn't, the old phrase, anything that's not bolted down sort of comes to mind. Anything that Leopold could get from the people of the Congo, he forced them to get. He basically whipped, slashed his way through Central Africa and just did not care what the cost was going to be. Through a series of concessionary he did this and sold these things on the world market through a series of international concessionary companies, even though its ostensible purpose in the region was to uplift the local people and develop the area. Keep in mind that the initial push into the Congo was supposed to have been a missionary effort. They entered the Congo under the guise of establishing commerce and goodwill with the people of the Congo. And this is what it turned into. Under Leopold II's administration, the Congo Free State became one of the greatest international scandals of the early 20th century. The Casement Report of the British consul Roger Casement led to the arrest and punishment of officials who'd been responsible for killings during a rubber-collecting expedition in 1903. The loss of life and atrocities inspired literature such as Joseph Conrad's novel Heart of Darkness and raised an international outcry amongst other foreign powers, despite the fact that some of them were even implementing some of these horrendous practices. Debate has been ongoing about the high death rate during this period. The boldest estimates state that the forced labor system led directly and indirectly to the deaths of 50% of the population. The lack of accurate reports makes it difficult to quantify the number of deaths caused by the ruthless exploitation and the lack of immunity to new diseases introduced by contact with European colonists, like the 1889-1890 flu pandemic, which caused millions of deaths on the European continent, including Prince Baudouin of Belgium, who succumbed to the deadly virus in 1891. Also a little bit of poetic justice there. During the Congo Free State propaganda war, European and U.S. reformers exposed atrocities in the Congo Free State to the public through the Congo Reform Association, which was founded by Roger Casement and the journalist, author, and politician E.D. Morrill. Also active in exposing the activities of the Congo Free State was the author Arthur Conan Doyle, whose book, The Crime of the Congo, was widely read in the early 1900s. By 1908, public pressure and the diplomatic maneuvers of other nations led to the end of Leopold II's rule and to the annexation of the Congo Free State as a colony of Belgium. It became known thenceforth as the Belgian Congo, and in addition, a number of major Belgian investment companies pushed the Belgian government to take over the Congo and develop the mining sector as it was virtually untapped. Of course, I'm a little skeptical as to whether or not they pushed them away from rubber because it was more lucrative to go into mining, or because they knew that the jig was up and they couldn't get away with what they were doing anymore. So it's time to go into this. Now, I mentioned early on, I talked about the 1876 or the expedition of Henry Morton Stanley, who was working with British missionary David Livingstone in Africa in 1871. He later explored the region during a journey that ended in 1877 and was described in Stanley's 1878 novel, Through the Dark Continent. Failing to enlist British interest in developing the Congo region, he took up service with Leopold II, who hired him to gain a foothold in the region and annex the region for himself. Now, from 1879 to 1884, Stanley was in the Congo Basin, where he would build the road from Lower Congo up to Stanley Pool and launch steamers on the upper river. Now, while exploring the Congo for Leopold, he set up treaties with local chiefs. I mentioned this earlier. Few to none of these tribal leaders had a realistic idea of what they were signing, and in essence, the documents gave over all rights of their respective pieces of land to King Leopold II. With Stanley's help, Leopold was able to claim a great area along the river, and military posts were shortly established by a private army instituted by Leopold. Christian de Bonchamps, a French explorer who also served Leopold in Katanga, expressed attitudes towards such treaties shared by many Europeans, saying that the treaties with these little African tyrants, which generally consist of four long pages of which they do not understand a word and to which they sign a cross in order to have peace and to receive gifts, are really only serious matters for the European powers. In the event of disputes over the territories, they do not concern the black sovereign who signs them for a moment. So clearly these treaties were a way of the European colonists and the European colonial powers to dictate that to dictate to one another who owned what. It wasn't really about, it never had been about, you know, really truly legally acquiring land from these people, because they couldn't read this crap. They had no idea what the hell they were signing. They didn't speak Dutch. They didn't read Dutch. They read Congolese, or whatever the equivalent of their language had been at that time. We know that they spoke a plethora of languages in this part of the world. They didn't understand what they were signing. They were just told, if you sign this, we're going to give you good stuff. We're going to give you food. We're going to give you water. We're going to take care of you. Just sign this paper and everything's going to be fine. Upon signing these things, these agents of the state would go back to the king of their respective country and say, look, we've brokered a deal with these local chieftains. They understand we're coming in, and they've given it up. They've decided to just give in to your magnanimity, magnanimousness. They're going to give up their land to you. And this is why we have such conflicts as arise in the Congo, because then the missionaries go away and the soldiers arrive, and these local chieftains are now wondering, what in the hell's going on? Where are the gifts we were promised? Well, now we get soldiers. Soldiers are not gifts. And it quickly turns into another – it quickly becomes apparent to these people that they're not going to be getting gifts. They're going to be treated very poorly. So it's a great game for the Europeans who are coming to this land, to these foreign lands with their documents. For them, everything has to be quantified, documented. But for these people in these regions – they're putting their trust in people. They're trusting them at their word. And that is what's really leading to the cost of such lives and to the cost of their natural resources. They're being taken advantage of, in many, many cases. Now, King Leopold, again, after getting these documents, creates a plan to convince the other European powers of the legitimacy of his claim to the region, all while maintaining the guise that his work is for the benefit of the native peoples under the name of a philanthropic association. He launched a publicity campaign in Britain to distract critics, drawing attention to Portugal's record of slavery and offering to drive slave traders from the Congo Basin. And the reason that King Leopold does this is is quite simple. He wants everybody else to stay out of the Congo. We want everybody else out. And he offers to drive slave traders away from the Congo Basin, not because he cares about the people of the Congo, and not because he really wants people to think, oh, look at how nice of a guy King Leopold is. No, it's because he wants to use the Congolese people as his labor force. And you can't do that if there are slavers in the region taking people from the Congo to be slaves somewhere else. That's just not going to work for you. So Leopold does this, and it has the desired effect. People begin to be able to say, well, you know, Leopold's driving out all the slavers. He's really going to take care of these people. He also secretly tells British merchant houses that if he was given formal control of the Congo for this and other humanitarian purposes, he would then give them the same most favored nation, MFN status, Portugal had offered them. At the same time, Leopold promised Bismarck, Otto von Bismarck, for those of you not in the know on Bismarck, the advisor to Kaiser Wilhelm II of Germany, that he would not give any one nation special status and that German traders would be as welcome as any other. Leopold then offered France the support of the Association for French Ownership of the entire Northern Bank of the Congo and sweetened the deal by proposing that if his personal wealth proved insufficient to hold the entire Congo, as seemed utterly inevitable, that it should revert to France. On April 23rd in 1884, the International Association's claim on the Southern Congo Basin was formally recognized by France on the condition that France got the first option to buy the territory if the association decided to sell. So everybody else, leading up to what happens in the Congo Rubber Terra, every other country is totally taken in by Leopold. They are just all on board. Whether they knew what he was going to do or not, they are all in. They see the profits. They see this coming, and they see their pocketbooks getting purses are going to swell up, and they can smell it. So they are all in on helping King Leopold substantiate his claim here. This may have also helped. So this instance helps Leopold in gaining recognition from his claim by the other major powers, who thus wanted him to succeed instead of selling his claims to France. So when France so France makes things worse after Leopold says, yeah, you know, if things don't work out, if I can't afford to hold on to this anymore, you guys can swoop right in. It's yours. I'll let you have the first crack at buying it. So right off the bat, as soon as everybody else, Britain, Germany, the United States, as soon as all these other countries find out that France is going to be the first one on deck to get this territory, which appears to be rich in natural resources, if Leopold should fail in squeezing some wealth out of it, they immediately become all about him. They immediately say, oh, yeah, we really hope that Leopold's successful because we don't want France to get it because nobody likes them. He also enlists the aid of the United States, sending President Chester A. Arthur carefully edited copies of the cloth and trinket treaties British explorer Henry Morton Stanley claimed to have negotiated with various local authorities, and proposing that as an entirely disinterested humanitarian body, the association would administer the Congo for the good of all, handing over power to the locals as soon as they were ready for that responsibility. So they send a message over to the President of the United States saying, we're going to, with these treaties that they supposedly had signed, doctored and edited, of course, to, you know, make it look like people actually signed it and read it. And, basically they send over some extra documents that say, yeah, once we've got these people up and running and they can take care of themselves, we're going to give them the power. That's right. We're going to make them a democracy. They're going to be running themselves. Even though not a single person had any thought of giving this up. They were not in any sense of the word. Leopold and his people were not in any sense planning on giving the power to these people. Now, Leopold was able to attract scientific and humanitarian backing for the International African Association, which he formed during a Brussels Geographic Conference of Geographic Societies, Explorers, and Dignitaries that he hosted in 1876. At this conference, he proposed establishing an international benevolent committee for the propagation of civilization among the peoples of Central Africa, the Congo region. originally conceived as a multinational scientific and humanitarian assembly. Now, the AIA, or International African Association, became a development company controlled eventually entirely by Leopold. Now, after 1879 and the crumbling of the International African Association, Leopold's work was done under the auspices of Committee for Studies of the Upper Congo. The committee, supposedly an international commercial, scientific, and humanitarian group, was in fact made up of a group of businessmen who had shares in the Congo with Leopold, holding a large block by proxy. The committee itself eventually disintegrated, but Leopold continued to refer to it and use the defunct organization as a smokescreen for his operations in laying claim to the Congo. So not only was Leopold planning on exploiting the people of the Congo, he was going to commit fraud while doing it the entire time and lie about as much as possible en route to doing so. Now, following, once Leopold had control, we talked about some of the policies that he instituted. Now, here's some of the problems, though, that Leopold faced. We didn't mention this, and I want to get into this. These are some of the problems that Leopold faced when he finally gets complete control over the Congo Free State. Now, Leopold no longer needed the facade of the association and replaced it with an appointed cabinet of Belgians who would do his bidding. To the temporary new capital of Boma, he sent a governor general and a chief of police. The vast Congo Basin would be split up into 14 administrative districts, each district into zone, and each zone into sectors, and each sector into posts. From the district commissioners down to the post, every appointed head was European. With little financial means, however, the Free State mainly relied on local elites to rule and tax the vast and hard-to-reach Congolese interior. Leopold pledged to suppress the East African slave trade, promote humanitarian policies, guarantee free trade with the colony, and impose no import duties for 20 years, and encourage philanthropic and scientific enterprises. Beginning in the mid-1880s, Leopold first decreed that the state asserted rights of proprietorship over all vacant lands throughout the Congo territory. In three successive decrees, he promised the rights of the Congolese and their land and native villages and farms, essentially making all of the CFS state-owned land, and Leopold further decreed that merchants should limit their commercial operations in rubber trade with the natives. Additionally, the colonial administration liberated thousands of slaves who were then going to be slaves. Now, Leopold II, here are the four major problems that presented themselves over the next few, over the initial few years of Leopold's rule of the Congo Free State. First off, Leopold II ran up huge debts to finance his colonial endeavor and risked losing his colony to Belgium. Much of the Free State was unmapped jungle, which offered little fiscal and commercial returns. In number three, Cecil Rhodes, the prime minister of the British Cape Colony, part of modern South Africa, was expanding the British South Africa Company's charter lands from the south and threatened to occupy Katanga, which was southern Congo, by exploiting the principle of effectivity loophole in the Berlin Treaty. This was supported by Harry Johnston, British Commissioner for Central Africa, who was London's representative in the region. And four, the Congolese interior was ruled by Arab Zanzibari slavers and sultans, powerful kings and warlords who had to be coerced or defeated by use of force. For example, the slaving gangs of Zanzibar trader Tipu Tip had a strong presence in the eastern part of the territory in the modern-day Maniema and Tanganyika and Ituri regions. They were linked to the Swahili coast via Uganda and Tanzania and had established independent slave states. So, problems in its opening. Now, Leopold could not meet the early costs of running the Free State. He desperately set into motion a system to maximize his revenue. The first change was the introduction of the concept of terras vacantes, vacant land, which was any land that did not contain a habitation or cultivated garden plot. All of this land, i.e. most of the country, was therefore deemed to belong to the state. Servants of the state, namely any men in Leopold's employ, were encouraged to exploit it by any means necessary. Now, shortly after anti-slavery conferences were held in Brussels in 1889, Leopold issued a new decree which said that Africans could only sell their harvested products, ivory or rubber, to the state in a large part of the free state. This law grew out of the earlier decree that all unoccupied land belonged to the state. So because of this, a lot of trading groups lost out. And this meant that a lot of people were about to lose a lot of money. In addition to a number of other factors, predominantly poor management on the part of the individuals in the free state that worked for Leopold, there was a scramble for Katanga by the British and the Dutch and a couple of other groups, the French and a few others, who were in the area of South and Central Africa, who all kind of wanted the same area. They then eventually reach a third problem once they, you know, finally sort that problem with the British out. They reach a third problem. The third problem is that of the African and Arab slavers, Tipu Tip, or otherwise known as Hamad bin Muhammad bin Juma bin Rajab el Murajebi, they had a little war in the Congo over that, which was temporarily solved. Initially, the authority of the Congo Free State was relatively weak in the eastern regions of the Congo. And so in 1887, Henry Morton Stanley arrives in Zanzibar and proposes that Tipu Tip be made governor, or Wali, of the Stanley Falls District. Both Leopold II and Bargash bin Said agree on February 24th of 1887, and Tipu Tip accepts. They do this because they're attempting to pacify more of the region. Now, in the longer term, this alliance was undefendable at home and abroad. Leopold II was heavily criticized by the European public for his dealings with Tipu Tip because he promised that he was going to end slavery in this region, and then he does not only not end slavery in the region, but then he makes a slaver, a known slaver, the guy that's going to help him run it. In Belgium, the Anti-Slavery Society, founded in 1888, aimed at abolishing the Arab slave trade in this region. Furthermore, Tipu Tip and Leopold were commercial rivals. Every person that Tipu Tip hunted down and put into chattel slavery and every pound of ivory he exported to Zanzibar was a loss to Leopold. This and Leopold's humanitarian pledges to the Berlin Conference to end slavery meant war was inevitable, and open warfare between the two factions broke out in late November of 1892. Both sides would fight by proxy, arming and leading the populations of the Upper Congo Forest in a conflict, and by early 1894, the Zanzibari Swahili slavers are defeated in the Eastern Congo region, and the Congo-Arab War comes to an end. So they don't even fight this war themselves. Both groups just sort of arm the population of the Congo and say, fight each other, fight your neighbors, and whoever wins gets all the land. So to do this, King Leopold arms natives and of course, Tipu Tip arms guys from the southern part of the country. They fight it out, and the last guy standing ended up being the Dutch, who were better armed. Finally, we get back to some of the specifics of the Congo Rubber Terror. So we've talked about a lot of the complications that arrive to administer to the state, but what other complications face the people? What sort of things did the people face? Well, we talked briefly about what Leopold and the policies Leopold instituted. But this is where things are going to get real. Now, to monopolize the resources of the entire Congo Free State, Leopold issued three decrees in 1891 and 1892 that reduced the native population to serfs. Collectively, these forced the natives to deliver all ivory and rubber harvested or found to state officials and state officers, thus nearly completing Leopold's monopoly of the ivory and rubber trade. The rubber came from wild vines in the jungle, which I mentioned earlier, and unlike the rubber from Brazil, which was tapped from trees, to extract the rubber, instead of tapping the vines, Congolese workers would slash them and lather their bodies with the rubber latex. When the latex hardened, it would be scraped off their skin, extraordinarily painful manner, as it took off the workers' hair with it. The Force Publique, or FP, Leopold's private army, was used to enforce the rubber quotas. Early on, the FP was used primarily to campaign against the Arab slave trade. We mentioned Tipu Tip in the Upper Congo, and protect Leopold's economic interests and suppress the frequent uprisings within the state. The FP officer corps included only white Europeans, Belgian regular soldiers, and mercenaries enlisted from other countries. Now, on arriving in the Congo, these recruited men from Zanzibar in West Africa and eventually from the Congo itself. In addition, Leopold had actually been encouraging the slave trade among Arabs in the Upper Congo in return for slaves to fill in the ranks of the FP. So he then enlists slaves to his military force in this region to bolster his numbers. Now, during the 1890s, the FP's primary role was to exploit the natives as corvée laborers to promote the rubber trade. Now, many of the black soldiers were far-off peoples of the Upper Congo, while others had been kidnapped in raids on villages in their childhood and brought to Roman Catholic missions, where they received a military training in conditions close to slavery. Modern weapons and a chicote, which is a bullwhip made of hippopotamus hide, the FP routinely took and tortured hostages, slaughtering families of rebels and flogging and raping Congolese people. They also burned recalcitrant villages, and above all, they cut off the hands of Congolese natives, including the children. When a village rebelled against the FP and Leopold's harsh policies, the FP would arrive in their village, oftentimes in the middle of the night, burn them out of their homes, and those people unfortunate enough to have not escaped or survived, or to have survived this ordeal, would then be summarily rounded up in the center of what remained of their village and be mutilated in front of one another, down to the last woman and child. Those who resisted would be put to death summarily by either being whipped to death or shot. The human hands were then collected as trophies on the orders of their officers to show that their bullets had indeed not been wasted. Officers were concerned that their subordinates might waste their ammunition on hunting animals for sport. As I mentioned before, they didn't want these individuals to use weapons for their own benefit. They wanted to use these weapons for the benefit of the state. And as I mentioned earlier, again, I'd like to reiterate that King Leopold was intent on making a profit and not wasting any money. And bullets, they cost money. But cutting the hands off a small child, that doesn't cost you anything. Except, you know, human decency and morality. But that's okay if you're King Leopold. Now, their officers became incredibly concerned about resources. So they required soldiers to submit one hand for every bullet spent. These mutilations also served to further terrorize the Congolese into submission. This is all contrary to the promises of uplift made at the Berlin Conference, which had recognized the Congo Free State as a Belgian territory under the control of the King of Belgium, King Leopold II. Now, mutilation did not only occur as a consequence of rebellion. Failure to meet the rubber collection quotas was punishable by death. Meanwhile, the FP were required to provide the hand of their victims as proof when they had shot and killed someone, as was believed that they would otherwise use munitions imported from Europe at a considerable cost for hunting. As a consequence, the rubber quotas were in part paid off in chopped hands. Sometimes the hands were collected by the soldiers of the FP, and sometimes by villages themselves. There were even small wars where villagers attacked neighboring villages to gather hands since their rubber quotas were too unrealistic to fill. So, not only were these people forced to cut, not only were these people instructed to cut off people's hands, but in addition, these hands became a form of currency for even the villagers themselves who were underneath this tyrannical rule. In order to meet these extreme quotas, they either had to literally work themselves to death, or they had to attack their neighbors and steal the collected hands that they had so that they could pay off their debts to King Leopold and prove that they were taking care of stuff. A Catholic priest quotes a man named Tswambe, speaking of the hated state official Leon Fivieses, who ran a district along the 500 kilometers of river north of Stanley Pool. He says, "All saw this man as the devil of the equator. From all the bodies killed in the field, you had to cut the hands off." He wanted to see the number of hands cut off by each soldier who had to bring them in baskets. A village which refused to provide rubber would be completely swept clean. As a young man, I saw Fievez's soldier Maloli, then guarding the village of Boyeka, take a net and put 10 arrested natives in it, attach big stones to the net, and make it tumble into the river. Rubber causes these torments. That's why we no longer want to hear its name spoken. Soldiers made young men kill or rape their own mothers and sisters for their entertainment. So this is a survivor of one of these village, these attacks on villages in the Congo. One junior European officer described a raid to punish a village that had protested. The European officer in command ordered us to cut off the men and hang them on the village palisades, and to hang the women and children on the palisade in the form of a cross. After seeing a Congolese person killed for the first time, a Danish missionary wrote, the soldier said, don't take this to heart so much. They kill us if we don't bring the rubber. The commissioner had promised us, if we have plenty of hands, he will shorten our service. In the words of Forbath, the baskets of severed hands, set down at the feet of European post commanders, became the symbol of the Congo Free State. The collection of hands became an end in itself. FP soldiers brought them to the stations in place of rubber. They even went out and harvested them instead of rubber. They became a sort of currency. They came to be used to make up for shortfalls in rubber quotas, to replace the people who were demanded for the forced labor gangs, and the FP soldiers were paid their bonuses on the basis of how many hands they collected. So in the end, it became all about cruelty and less about profit at this point. In theory, each right hand proved a killing. In practice, some soldiers cheated by simply cutting off the hand and leaving the victim to live or die. More than a few survivors later said that they had lived through a massacre by acting dead, not moving, even when their hand was severed, and waiting till the soldiers left before seeking help. In some instances, a soldier could shorten his service term by bringing more hands than the other soldiers, which led to widespread mutilations and dismemberments on Congolese people. So as you can see, this was a terrible place and a terrible time to be alive in. A reduction of the population of the Congo is noted by all who've compared the country at the beginning of Leopold's control with the beginning of Belgian state rule in 1908, but estimates of the death toll vary considerably. Estimates of some contemporary observers suggest that the population decreased by half during this period. Now, according to Edmund D. Morel, the Congo Free State counted 20 million souls. Hence, Mark Twain, the writer, mentioned the number of 10 million deaths. Now, according to British diplomat Roger Casement, this depopulation had four main causes: indiscriminate war, starvation, reduction of births, and deaths. Sleeping sickness was also a major cause of fatality at the time. Opponents of Leopold's rule stated, however, that the administration itself was to be considered responsible for the spreading of this epidemic. Now, in the absence of a census providing even an initial idea of the size of the population of this region at the inception of the Congo Free State, the first which was taken in 1924, it's impossible to truly quantify the population changes during this period. Despite this, Forbath more recently claimed the loss was at least 5 million. And that's according to the River Congo, the discovery, exploration, and exploitation of the world's most dramatic river. So if you guys want to take a look at Forbath's work, I think you should. P. Forbath. Good look at the Congo during this time. Now, Adam Hochschild and Jan Vasinha use the number 10 million as well. Hochschild cites several recent independent lines of investigation by anthropologist Jan Vasinha and others that examine local sources, police records, religious records, oral traditions, genealogies, and personal diaries, which generally agree with the assessment of the 1919 Belgian Commission. Roughly half the population perished during the Free State period. Since the official census by Belgian authorities in 1924 put the population at about 10 million people, these various approaches suggest that a rough estimate of a total of 10 million people died prior to the first census. Now, Vasinha returned to the issue of quantifying the total population decline and revised
his earlier position, he concluded that the Cuba population, one of the many Congolese populations, was rising during the first two decades of the Leopold II's rule and declined with 25% 1800 to 1919, mainly due to sickness. Others argued a decrease of 20% over the first 40 years of colonial rule up to the census of 1924. According to Congolese historian Isidore Nzim, 13 million people died. According to his work, Historia General du Congo, so it's his work on the people of the Congo and a genealogical record that he attempted to put together. To put these population changes in context, source references state that in 1900, Africa as a whole had approximately between 90 and 133 million people in it. At least this part. However, no veritable records exist. Louise and Stanger's state that the population figures at the start of Leopold's control are only wild guesses, while calling Edie Morrill's attempt and others at coming to a figure for population losses but figments of the imagination. And this is according to J. Stanger's and R. Louise. Edie Morrill's History of the Congo Reform Movement is their work. However, authors point out that the lack of reliable demographic data are questioned by others calling the former minimalists and agnosticists, proving that, and this is in A. Rose, Towards a History of Mass Violence, in the Etat Independent du Congo from 1885 to 1908, and that's with the South African Historical Journal, for those of you looking for source material to go check out. Proving that these questions remain the object of heated debate. So this is still a heavily debated incident that's taken place. And despite that, King Leopold and his involvement in this have almost kind of fallen under the radar. But nonetheless, in conclusion, the actions of King Leopold's FP forces in the Congo Free State committed atrocities that fortunately for us, we've been lucky not to see too many duplications of this kind of cruelty. You know, this is a precursor to some of the cruelty we would see in later periods. And really, it's something that we clearly didn't learn from as we went into the First World War, not really caring a whole lot about loss of life, and then went into the Second World War, only to get another genocide. So this is but one genocide in what would be a long line of genocides that occur well into the 90s. And depending on who you ask, there are still some debates as to whether or not we may have missed out on one here in more modern times. Or I should say more contemporary times. But nonetheless, this is an incident that has more or less skirted under recognition by many, many historians. It's still a matter of debate amongst certain circles as to how many people were killed as a result of the Congo Free State policies. But one thing we cannot overstate is that King Leopold's policies were, in fact, devastating to the population. We don't know necessarily today how many people died, but we do know that significant portions of the population were completely wiped out. We do know that entire villages were wiped, and we do know that many people, even after the Belgians leave this region, were left maimed and horribly scarred as a consequence of these practices. Guys, I hope you learned a lot today. I hope these things have stuck with you, and I hope that this does not leave from you, that it doesn't skirt under the radar for you anymore, that this is something that you can learn a lesson from, and that is a lesson about human kindness and dignity, showing other people a little bit of decency. Now, if you want to take out more on this, you might want to check out Heart of Darkness, the novella by Polish-British novelist Joseph Conrad, which is an incredibly famous piece of literature. You can also check out a number of the sources that I sort of name drop throughout our episode here. You can take a look at Hochschild's King Leopold's Ghost. You may want to take a look at
That's Adam Hochschild's King Leopold's Ghost, more specifically, A Story of Greed, Terror, and Heroism in Colonial Africa. You may want to take a look at Jan Vecina's Being Colonized, The Cuba Experience in Rural Congo from 1880 to 1960. You may also want to take a look at E.D. Morrill's King Leopold's Rule in Africa and Peter Forbath, The River Congo, The Discovery, Exploration, and Exploitation of the World's Most Dramatic Rivers, published with Harper & Row. So that's all I've got for you guys today. I hope that despite the unpleasantness of the topic, that you guys learn a little bit and that you enjoy the content to a degree. It's always a great thing when we get to dig a little bit deeper into the political machinations of these various characters from history. It really brings to life that even if they are terrible people, they are still people, reminding us that we can never underestimate of human beings to be complete and utter shitpots. But until next time, this has been another presentation of the Bareback Facts, courtesy of Totally Driven Entertainment. And of course, you guys can catch me Friday at 5 p.m. Eastern Time when we talk about King Assurbanipal, the first king of Assyria, a very interesting and, dare I say, cruel individual whose cruelty and savagery probably can eclipse, if not come close to, the work of King Leopold. But we'll find out. Until then, hope you guys enjoy the rest of your week, and I'll be seeing you soon.